Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Over the past several decades, there has been an increasing attention on the growth of Islamic fundamentalism. Many observers have seen this general religious movement as being transnational, linking supporters across state boundaries and promoting an identity that is first and foremost religious, not territorial. Authors such as the late Samuel Huntington have looked at this trend and speculated that conflicts in our contemporary world will be less oriented around national conflicts, but rather they will be clashes of civilizations, to use the title of one of his last books. Other scholars, coming from different theoretical directions, have observed that the concept of religious community, known in Islam as the Ummah, are not compatible with this manner in which political units have been arranged in the post-Westphalian nation-state system. Borders drawn in the Middle East, Asia, and Africa during the era of European imperialism make little sense to a faith tradition that seeks to unite people based on theological ideas and not necessarily a given territory in which those people reside. Those scholars also posit that the difficulty in matching the concept of the Ummah with the modern territorial state will also give rise to socio-political turbulence. The events of the Arab Spring and the civil war raging in Syria at present may lend some credence to those views, or they may not. To examine the question of how the Islamic concept of Ummah, or community of believers, is connected to the notion of territoriality, I am pleased to be joined today with Matthew Derrick, an assistant professor of geography at Humboldt State University in Arcata, California. Professor Derrick recently published an article entitled, Containing the Ummah? Islam and the Territorial Question. He published that in the Interdisciplinary Journal of Research on Religion, which is an academic journal affiliated with Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion and is free to the public with a simple registration. We will be talking with Matthew about his article, but for those of you interested in the written piece itself, please visit our website where you can find a link to it. Matt, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, Tony. Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Hey, I got a quick question before we begin here. I went to the Humboldt University Department of Geography website, and there's a picture of you seated on what appears to be an ice chair. Now, for somebody who just wrote an article on Islam, the stereotypical vision of Islam, it's in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So I'm expecting pyramids or camels or something like that. What gives with this whole ice chair business?
Well, that's a picture of me up in Russia, and this is something that people don't often recognize, that Russia is part of the geographical construct that we understand as the Muslim world. In fact, we have there's probably about 20 million Muslims who live in Russia natively, not necessarily as immigrants as other parts of Europe, but natively. And where I'm sitting on that ice sculpture is in a semi-autonomous region known as Tajikistan, the capital of which is Kazan, which is about 500 miles east of Russia. So within, the great expanse of Russia, that's really in the heart of Russia. And so, it's right in the middle of Russia where you have those cold winters, where you have ice sculptures and thrones that researchers like myself can sit on. And it's something really beautiful to see a minaret covered in snow, and somehow it seems a bit contradictory. So you're right. So
yeah, that is something that we do need to realize, is that a lot of the former Soviet republics of Tajikistan and other places like that, Kazakhstan, they have majority Muslim populations. We often don't associate it with that.
Right. In the area I study, Tajikistan, this is part of Russia itself, right in the heart of it. And when we think about Islam within Russia, we generally think about the case of Chechnya.
Right.
And this is because of obvious reasons, a civil war that is dragged out right now in kind of a muted way, but it's been dragged out for two decades since the fall of the Soviet Union. But Tatarstan is right in the center, and unlike Chechnya, it has avoided conflict. It's been pretty peaceful. And what is fascinating about Tatarstan, the area I studied, what first attracted me there as a master's student studying that area, was the fact that Tatarstan is inhabited in relatively, in roughly even numbers of Sunni Muslim Tatars, the titular group, the indigenous group, and Orthodox Russians. And it's remained peaceful in spite of the fact that Tatarstan, like Chechnya, in the kind of the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union, declared itself a sovereign state. But there was negotiations that went between Moscow and Kazan, again, the capital of Tatarstan, throughout this whole period, and they managed to avoid conflict. And that's what originally attracted me to that area to study.
Hey, I got a question. You mentioned Tatarstan. I'm probably pronouncing it a little bit wrong, but this is one thing that I've always wondered. And, you know, I've looked at history and looked at the Mongols and the Tartars and things like that. Is that where the word tartar sauce comes from?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, the word Tatar, if we look at it, this comes from you're correct in identifying them with the kind of the Mongol horde, as the Europeans like to call it.
Right.
You know, the Golden Horde, which was up there through Russia, came through 13th century. One of their main Khanates was based there in Kazan, where I studied. And the word Tatar, actually, as an ethnonym, literally meant kind of vanguard, the conquered people. As the Mongols were sweeping through Eurasia, the peoples that they would conquer would form, again, the vanguard of the armies that rushed through that area. And so you'd have people like the Russians who were being, conquered. They would say the Tatars are coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally it means vanguard. And so there is perhaps some, I'm not sure what the combination is with Tatar, but Tatar is a T-A-T-A-R, and the Tartar sauce, T-A-R-T-A-R. There might be some connection between the two, but I'm not quite sure.
Ah, okay. So, see, I'm misspelling it. That's
yeah.
My problem. Oh, okay. Because
right.
Usually
but the people
I think
I do study are, they can trace their ancestry to the Mongols who swept through that area for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So that's my bad too. I'm one of the things I love doing this podcast is I always get corrected and learn different stuff here. So now I've learned how to spell tartar sauce, the stuff you put on your food, as compared to the Tartars, who were the vanguard of conquering the Russians way back in medieval era and such like that.
Right.
Hey, so that's the area that you study, but the article that we're talking about today is a general piece that deals with Islam as a community in general. How did you get interested in this large theoretical question about Islam and physical territory?
Well, I came through it again through my interest in Russia. I consider myself a Russianist, well, a Russianist more broadly speaking, not so much as cultural Russia as, thinking Dostoevsky and those people, but in Russia itself as a region, it's a fascinating place, multicultural, multi-religious, that people forget because Russia's always been framed as, throughout the Tsarist period, it was seen as an Orthodox expanse, and then for much of the 20th century, an atheist communist expanse.
Mm-hmm.
But so I became interested in this question of territory through my study of this region. And when I first started studying this area, I began my graduate studies not long after 9/11, and I heard about this region within Russia where again Muslims and Christians live together peacefully. In spite of this kind of, in the 90s, the Tatars had posted this a pretty aggressive sovereignty campaign and were, in a certain way, a de facto independent state within Russia. And then with the rise of Putin and Putinism, this re-centralization of Russia, the territorial freedoms that they had enjoyed throughout the 90s have been rolled back. And the question that struck me is, why hadn't there been a vociferous, a violent response to this? And so I became interested in it first through this territorial issue, this idea of controlling your own space, your historical homeland, And while I was doing my field work as a master's student back in 2003, 2004, then I started getting interested in this question of Islam through it. And what we'd seen is throughout the 90s in this region, Islam was seen as kind of a secular source of national identity. And what people had been becoming concerned about in the early 2000s, and increasingly, since then, is what has been framed as an upswing of fundamentalism or other conservative forms of religious identity.
Mm-hmm. Stuff and, that crosses boundaries.
No, that's part of how it's been framed.
Right.
But it's within that region that we've seen a shift in Islamic and religious expression within this area. And so I step back and you look at the broader literature on Islam that is especially in kind of the post 9/11 environment that has come out. It seemed to fit in with these broader understandings of Islam, and as a culture, it doesn't recognize the separation between mosque and state, and that religious identity will outweigh other forms of identity, but national identity, which is kind of seen as a Western construct.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I started exploring the other literatures that are out there throughout the social scientific disciplines. And so what I wanted to do is kind of place my research within the different literatures. And what became clear to me, this was not a question of Islam per se, but again, the question at the heart of this issue that I was studying was territory and kind of more national, how a national community is framed and understood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I positioned myself against kind of again, a broader social scientific approach to Islam.
Well, we're going to be talking a little bit more about that, but let's go ahead and define some of our terms as it relates to Islam, because a lot of the podcasts that we've done here on research on religion have focused on Christianity, and we've had a few on Islam, but it's an area that I'm increasingly interested in, but have a lot of to learn, so I'm sure that many of our listeners do as well. Your article really kind of focuses on this term, the Ummah, and whether it can or cannot be territorially contained. Well, that's a hard word, territoriality. And you geographers must have good pronunciation of these words. Anyways, the Ummah is the question is, can it be territorially contained? But this is the question that comes up is really a definitional question to begin with, and that's a question of the Ummah. So what is the Ummah?
Well, it's understood as kind of the international community of Islamic believers, Muslims as a whole internationally is where it comes from, how we understand today, how it's framed. And, in positioning, being deliberately provocative with that title, and I'm again positioning myself against these broader kind of cultural explanations, and when coming out of people, hopefully we'll get onto this issue, people like Huntington and Bernard Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of comes from this idea that as Huntington states, that the the Ummah, which sees itself as a single cultural entity, is somehow averse to the modern political territorial order. But if we look at the word Ummah, how it's entered the modern political discourse, let's step back. Before it entered the modern political discourse, it was used in the Quran and the Hadith in many different contexts with many, many different meanings. It could have been a language community, a kin community. Most of the references to the Ummah, though, in fact, were the followers of the Prophet Muhammad, but it was used in many different contexts throughout, again, the Quran and the Hadith. But it entered the modern political discourse really only in the 19th century, this era of nationalism, and the person who popularized it was Al Afghani, a religious reformer that was active throughout, you know, the Middle East. And his conceptualization of the Ummah was used, he used it to understand in this as a nation. And it, this was kind of expressed in explicitly modernist terms. And how it was being conceptualized in Europe, but the defining trait obviously here was religion and not necessarily language.
Mm-hmm. Or territory or space.
Or territory at that point.
Right, okay.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, the Ummah is supposedly this entity that does transcend physical territory. It's a connected, the defining feature, as you just mentioned, is religious affiliation. Or so you're a geographer. And territory or space is probably of crucial analytical importance to you. I find that issue of political territory to be rather fascinating, and I might have some differences with your approach, which I think we'll discuss here. But so you talked about Ummah, but what is really important for your discussion of the Ummah and territory is this modern notion of territory, and more specifically, the modern notion of the nation state. So when we talk about territory, and when you put that into your title, what do you mean? Give us a little historical background to the emergence of this concept of modern territory and the nation state.
Well, the nation state is this idea that political territories represent a defined people, and how it's been employed within the social sciences as some type of fixed entity, almost a primordial type of spatial referent. But it really is a historically contingent understanding of space, and most generally we can trace it back to 1648 and the Peace of Westphalia. Obviously, it didn't suddenly arrive out of this, but what the Peace of Westphalia did was you put an end to the 30 years' war over kind of religious difference and religious wars. And it was kind of clear to all the parties involved that there would be no end to this war unless they could reach some type of realistic agreement. But let's step back for a second. I'm getting ahead of myself. If we look at the way space and territory were organized within Europe at that time, again, this idea that we're saying the nation state comes from Europe. There was a series of kind of overlapping spatialities. You had fiefdoms, the entire Holy Roman Empire, princedoms, city-states, and there was no clear demarcation of control over space or borders as we understand them now. And so what happened with the 30 Years' War, the 1648 and the Peace of Westphalia, kind of the organizing principle of it was this Latin understanding of quius rego, Eos religio, basically was the understanding that, he who rules decides the religion of the realm. This was the principle of non-interference coming in here. And at this time, you also have to think about technological advances that were coming out of this time, the ability to draw borders. And yes, we can go back through history. There have always been states, but the idea of discrete states with discrete borders didn't really exist. You speak of frontiers, perhaps, but this idea of discrete borders is kind of coming out of the advances come out of the Enlightenment and this new rational approach.
Let me go ahead and stop you there, because again, I come at this as a political scientist, and I do disagree with some of my colleagues in terms of this. But for me, and I'm an economist, and so one of the things that I look at when I think about states and territories is the ability to tax a population, to have an elite that is able to say, okay, this is the group of people that I can extract resources from to serve my own interest or to provide public goods, such as protection from roving bandits or something like that. And so I've have many of my colleagues talk about 1648 and the Peace of Westphalia as being a very crucial tipping point in history and how we think about the nation state system. But the way I think about it, and say back in the year 700 or even the 700 BC or 700 AD or Common Era and before the Common Era, is this issue of, well, you know, you have a population of people, they have settled down, they're going to engage in sedentary agriculture and create some villages, build some houses and such. And from this, especially after the Agrarian Revolution some 10,000 or so years ago, you start producing a surplus of resources, and you're able to feed or support an elite class, usually a political elite or a warrior elite, that says, okay, we'll defend this turf, this territory, and we'll create a boundary around this, right? This, you know, we go from that valley over to this river and up that mountain. That's kind of our turf, and the people within that are the people that will protect, and in exchange, they'll give us some taxes. They'll either bring baskets of wheat to us to help feed us, or once the economy becomes monetized, they'll bring money and other things like that. So for me, that the issue of the state and the nation has always somewhat been around for us. And I'm not really clear what the difference was between, say, 1647 and then 1649, that there was this year that they sat down and negotiated the treaty or several treaties of Westphalia and said, okay, this is how we're going to line things up. It just seemed whoever could grab that territory and tax that population would be the ruler of that population. And again, in the year 700, it was kind of difficult to do that because you didn't have the monitoring capacity. You didn't maybe have the military technology to defend it really well. So the borders, yeah, they were a little bit squishy. But, you know, I don't know. The nation state system for me goes back deeper than that. Could respond
right
to that.
You're completely right here that there have always been states and populations over which they ruled. I'm not saying that it's 1648 suddenly we had a new system, but it's a different understanding how sovereignty was justified. If we go back to the Holy Roman Empire preceding that, Charlemagne was seen as, you know, the earthly representative of God, and he was the sovereign representative. And this I'm going to give a little story about how sovereignty has been justified over this historical development. It's a historical development throughout time, and this is what we have to recognize with territory, is that it is not a static thing, and how it's understood has changed over time. So if we look again, kind of pre-1648, we'll just use that year.
Yeah, say go back to the 1300s or 800s or something. Yeah,
you know, back then the Holy Roman Empire was God sovereign on the earth, mm-hmm. and I was able to justify the rule over this. These overlapping territories, these overlapping spatialities. But what happened again with, you know, beginning with the Reformation, and you have people challenging his suzerainty, and leads up to these wars, and these wars are not going to be, they're not going to be decided without some type of realist notion. And this is where, again, we come up with this he who rules decides the religion. And this establishes this principle of a politically legal principle of sovereignty. So what we see here is a bit of a devolution of how sovereignty is understood from a singular type of Holy Roman Emperor to different kings through in different territories, who now, that is where the locus of legitimation is with sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And becomes a state idea that sovereignty does. And there wasn't an automatic kind of sorting out, going out from kind of a vertically overlapping spatialities. What happened within the 30 Years' War, we saw that, you know, these kind of proto-absolutist states to the west, England and France, who at that point were already kind of assuming the forms they have now, were best able to mobilize troops and resources through kind of these centralized institutions and come out victorious in these type of battles. So what we get from this is how sovereignty is understood, again, devolved to the state leaders, the kings. And after that, subsequently, we get a period of kind of systematic dedication to this realist notion of sovereignty until we have the rise of nationalism. You know, this, we have the Age of Enlightenment, and we have this idea that is undermining this notion that these separate kings are God's representatives on earth, and there enters another period of anarchy within the international system where sovereignty was no longer justified because these different kings were the locus of sovereignty. It came to this idea where sovereignty had to be justified through the people. Mm-hmm. So how I conceptualize it is, again, kind of a devolution of how sovereignty is justified. And with that, we start getting, again, from these vertically overlapping spatialities, a flattening of spatialities, and with kind of these firmer borders as we understand them today.
Well, let me ask you what that means there, flattening of spatiality. That's a geography term. I'm not a geographer. Okay. Explain that one to me.
Well, I, again, especially if we look in, you know, the areas that, you know, compromises Germany right now, it, you know, coming out of the 17th, 18th century, the Western proto-absolutist states were already relatively flat, and they'd already begun organizing territory, institutionalizing territory, centralized within them. But within the areas that compromised, you know, the rump of the Holy Roman Empire, you still had, you know, kind of feudal arrangements and competing claims to territory. Mm-hmm. There was it wasn't flat in the understanding that territory was discrete and separate at that point.
Okay, so like England and France and probably Spain at that time would be
exactly.
considered flat, right?
Exactly, but within kind of Central Europe. And so what we see, again, especially with the rise of nationalism, 18th, 19th century, and undermining this notion that the kings are sovereign representatives of God on earth, we start getting these movements and the idea that sovereignty was held by the people. And so if we had kind of state nations created before the age of nationalism toward the West, and with the age of nationalism, the idea is you had to create borders, again, discrete borders coming at this point, where the people were. And this is in the late 19th century, 1870, 1871, for Italy and Germany. This is when they appear on the map, again, as discrete units, finally.
Now, one of the other important landmarks you talk about in your paper is World War I. Mm-hmm. And that becomes very important, especially when we start to talk about the Islamic community. Why is World War I an important time when you say the idea of political territorial or the political territorial idea becomes solidified?
Well, this is where the Wilsonian idea of, you know, people's right to self-determination comes into play. And the ideas behind the nation state were more or less formalized with broader institution understanding. And I just want to point out kind of the three principles behind that came in to the international system at that point. You know, the one, again, that I point out in the paper is exclusivity, and this is the idea that the surface of the earth should be divided into a series of discreetly delimited territorial unions. Units. Space can't be shared, essentially. Mm-hmm. This is one idea behind the modern map that is much different than let's go back again to the pre-1648 and then also, you know, time after that, but also go back to, you know, the Middle Ages and times like that you were talking about. So exclusivity is one of them, and the idea of sovereignty, and that's the idea that states have ultimate control over their internal affairs. And the third idea would be the nation-state ideal, and this is the idea coming out of nationalism, that the territories, states, represent a people, and that is where the authority to exercise sovereignty comes from. So those are kind of the three principles that really came out of the World War I and that context.
And this is a relatively important time in history as well. You see the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, mm-hmm. which is the last of the great Islamic caliphates. And that brings us back to the question of the Islamic Ummah, or community of believers. So now we can put these two together. We got some concept of what the Ummah is. We have some concept of what this new modern notion of territory, or of how it's defined by sovereignty, in these three principles that you outline. So let's put these together. Now, your article is largely a response to a number of scholars who see the Ummah as incompatible with this modern notion of the sovereign nation state. And you point to two scholars in specific, Samuel Huntington, or the late Samuel Huntington, and Bernard Lewis, who I believe is still alive. Give us some background on what their arguments are before we start to pick those arguments apart.
Well, their arguments are kind of similar, but they're coming at it from separate disciplinary backgrounds.
Right.
Dr. Huntington was international relations scholar, and what he was trying to do, in the post-Cold War context, makes sense and try to create some type of framework how to understand we go forward in this how I understood the age of post-ideology. We've been separated by communist and capitalist democratic camps, and what he was saying was that we're going to identify more with the most basic cultural contents of human groups, which he described as cultures, and he outlined a number of different civilizations, and behind that also was this anxiety about the decline of the nation state. Although, if you really pay attention to what he's saying, that the nation state system is still really at the heart of what he's talking about, especially in vis-a-vis, the West versus the quote-unquote Muslim world, Islamic world. And so he was trying to say that, civilizations are more or less compatible. And one that he pointed out was, kind of less compatible with West versus the East on civilization. So he's coming at it from a very kind of cultural essentialist perspective here.
And if I remember, in his book, he draws a new map of the world that creates blobs of civilizations instead of the typical country maps that you usually see.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And but still, he doesn't. His critics within his own international relations community kind of go after him for, even though he talks about, globalization and perhaps the decline of the nation state, he still accepts the nation state as this naturalized order and doesn't really question the ideas behind them. And we'll get into that in a second. But to move on to Dr. Lewis, he was the one who first coined this phrase, clash of civilizations. But he's a historian, and he is trying to explain in his most recent books, I'm not sure if he's done anything recently, but the main books I'm thinking about, What Went Wrong and The Crisis of the Civilization, and looking at the response of Islam, the Muslim world, toward kind of Western domination, and trying to explain why Islam, even though it was in the European Dark Ages, was the more advanced of the two civilizations, he would say, why they fell behind. But, trying to make sense again of the situation today. And he goes back again looking at he's in the older traditional Orientalist school, looking at, text and explaining it through culture, as if culture is something set above, separate from, politics, economics, and other social conditions. And so, they kind of complement each other by focusing on this idea of culture as being something primordial almost,
mm-hmm.
and how somehow Islam is incompatible with modernity as it's been set by the West. And so I position it start out against Huntington, but more so I'm kind of looking at the critics also of Huntington within his own IR camp, you know, people, we've had people doing kind of these quantitative studies showing that, you know, the borders between Islam and non-Islamic countries are no less bloody than other borders, or they're in fact, there's more violence between, more warfare between Muslim states than between Muslim and non-Muslim. And a problem I point out with this is that, again, what's kind of like Huntington, they accept this idea of the nation state without really kind of questioning the ideas behind it. Again, as a fixed spatiality that is almost naturalized.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also have within the IR community the so-called people the people allied with the so-called cultural turn, who again have questioned, you know, this idea of the nation state as the naturalized order, and what they have done is focused on you know, throwing out the nation state essentially and looking at culture again and giving the Muslim World Agency and this idea of the Ummah, the transnational Ummah, in this area, this era of globalization and, you know, international networks. But so what they've done is kind of met Huntington, as I see, in not problematizing the nation state and historicizing it, and looking at the ideas behind the nation state that have arisen through history, because the nation state and territory, modern territoriality, is in no way a naturalized spatial referent, but it has ideas that have, as I've discussed, ideas that have evolved throughout history, and there's been this coupling of space and identity, territory and identity, through these various epochs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I try to. I position myself within those various literatures.
Yeah, and it, you're transcending a lot of them, or bringing a lot of these things together. And I think this is one of the difficulty I've had understanding Huntington and Lewis and a few others. I'm more of a political economist, and you know, I just look at whatever you can tax is yours kind of thing. But the ideas that you bring up are very important here, and that brings us to the next section of your article, which is entitled with the subheading "The Changing Territorial Basis of Muslim Identities." And so here we have an ideational notion of identities mixed in here with a territorial concept. And so what is going on here with how Muslims, either most of them or maybe just a small fraction of them, influential elites, whoever it might be, how do they conceive of community or communities that they belong to and that they give legitimacy to?
I mean, before we get into this, I just like to step back. It's something you brought up that what I want to say is that I'm not creating some type of territorial deterministic framework here, but
right.
I guess the overriding goal within this piece is to insert this idea of territory and a consideration of the logic of
yes.
territory and how it might affect identity.
Yeah, you do that actually very well, and I should make that clear, is that you're not tossing the idea of territory overboard. In fact, you're poking Huntington and Lewis in the side and saying, hey, you really do got to take this a little bit more seriously.
Right, and not only those folks, but more broadly within the social sciences.
Right.
But to get to your question, if we look at what I do in that section of the paper, I provide kind of, you know, pre-imperial, you know, imperial identities and look at the post-imperial context within, you know, the broader Muslim world to see how changing political territorial circumstances have actually affected Muslim identities. And, you know, if we, there's this idea that the nation state and modern territoriality was simply grafted on the Muslim world. And for quite a large portion of the so-called Muslim world, the borders that they were left indeed were put in place by European with the process of European colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
But if we kind of go back and look at prior to explicit colonialism, we have, if we take the Ottoman Empire for example, in the attempt to modernize in the mid to late 1800s, there was this centralization taking in this idea, creating a more modern territorial entity, bringing in European notions of territorial administration. Until then, of course, it's been a highly decentralized empire with a millet system where different religious communities were essentially allowed to rule themselves. But what happened was, what I point out is that with this centralization, these hardening of borders, and creation of kind of more broader national institutions, people are starting to become socialized within this framework of Ottomanism. And the kind of a background of this also is with the Ottoman Empire losing its Christian territories in the Balkans, they start to get this broader kind of Turco-Arab identity. And this is where the Sultan really brought in al-Afghani and his idea of pan-Islamism, but it wasn't pan-Islamism to expand the territory of the caliphate, but what it was an effort to bridge kind of ethnic difference between the Arab segments and the Turkic segments, because what was going on with this spatial socialization of the different groups within the empire, Arabs started to identify as Arabs within here more broadly and began to resist this de facto Turkification. Because Ottomanism, to a large degree, was Turkification.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ideas of al-Afghani were employed within this territorial framework that was taking shape, the late 1800s and up to the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And if we go before then, we look at, al-Afghani, his ideas of pan-Islamism were largely formulated prior to that, 1870s, while he was in Egypt, and prior to the British occupation. And what he saw there was also a rise in nationalism among the Egyptians themselves. And this, the Egyptians had a long-standing sense of territory, a sense of cultural distinction, and we saw this rise of Egyptian nationalism prior to that. So the point being here that what we had was not a simple grafting on of European ideas. We could talk maybe a diffusion of these modern ideas of national community and also a diffusion of more modern territorial administrative techniques that gave rise to these more broadly national identities is what we had there.
Yeah, so this really starts to take shape too right around World War I. And
right.
The Ottoman Empire is basically a facade now, and it's about to crumble, and the Europeans come in and they basically carve everything up. So what happens there, and how does this affect the way people think about the Ummah or putting the Ummah back together again? And what is this tension between, growing nationalism? Does Egypt decide, hey, the Europeans got it right, we're going to follow their path, but other people say, no, we got to be Islamic brothers writ large?
Well, within kind of the interwar years, Islam didn't play much of a role in the formulation of group identity. The borders that were put in place by the British and the French largely, the institutions that were territorialized within them served to form to a degree the national identities that were territorial. There was a common Lebanese Arab identity taking form, Iraq and other places like that, formed largely against the European other, is what happened here. And while you might have had the older generation from the Ottoman days that had these ideas of pan-Islamism, you had this new generation come up, and they were socialized within these territorial institutions, militaries, schools, and so much, and so forth, that were, again, they were organized within these borders that, that had been created. And this was more kind of a territorial nationalism that, that, that came to be. And
it was also very secular, too.
Yes, it was very
right.
secular. And this was the language that was used to internalize this idea of secular nationalism that came to the fore. And this is reflective of again, a broader international system that came into being after World War I with those principles I was talking about. And so what we see is kind of the logic of territory working internally within the institutions that are organized within the territorial extent of these new states, but also, you know, justifying kind of of anti-colonial discourses within the broader international system that understood this idea of national self-determination. And the nation understood as the people within that territory, and so we get a common Arab identity, and we can you could debate to what degree it was formed within a place like Lebanon, where you had Christians and Muslim Arabs, but again they were this identity formed in juxtaposition against the colonial ruler.
Yeah, in fact, during the 1960s, it might have been a little bit earlier than the 50s, there was a movement afoot called Pan-Arabism
right.
that basically tried to, you know, define itself against the other and say, okay, listen, we got you carved us up all this way, but you know what? We're really Arabs and we got to resist. And, you know, part of it's the encroachment of Israel into the territory. You Europeans, like, plop them down here. And so that's what's happening here, too.
Yeah, that's coming in there. But this goes back to this idea of Pan-Arabism that comes out of the Ottoman context, and what we have is coming out of the post-colonial context. We have, if we go back and look at the two larger ideologies of Pan-Islamism and Pan-Arabism, what happened was they actually played out within the extent of each of these new territorial states.
Okay.
If we look at the record of Pan-Arabism in this period was a failure. These attempts to combine states to transcend these borders, one because rulers had developed their own interests within their own territories, but also that people began to identify with as Iraqis, Syrians, and so forth. And so, but what happened was we would see the Pan-Arab ideology play out within the territorial extent. Take, for example, Iraq. Ba'athism was, kind of extension of this Pan-Arab ideology mixed with socialism. Saddam Hussein employed this as an effort to unite, kind of the sectarian division between the Shia and the Sunnis within his state.
Right.
Okay, and so de facto, he didn't really consider the Kurds part of the nation. But so what the point being here, again, yes, Pan-Arabism came in, but these attempts to unite territories that had been drawn up by the imperial rulers were unqualified failures.
Mm-hmm. And, for me, I kind of understand what's going on here. And as somebody who just thinks from a political economy framework, mm-hmm. is that you have, these new territories after World War I and then after World War II, they really start taking shape. You're on your own now. Europe is withdrawn. And they say, hey, we have to secure our borders here. These are we might not like these borders. We have to have these borders, and so we're going to somehow create a nationalism around this. And you Shiites and you Sunnis are going to get along, and we're going to put it under the rubric of Ba'athism. Essentially what's going on? And efforts. What's interesting here too, and this gets us to the Ummah and to the extent of which the Ummah can be territorially contained or how it relates to space. Pan-Arabism flopped.
I
heard the
terms.
Yemen
came together over the north and south. But
yeah.
See the issues they're dealing with now. That's kind of the example that you know, that proves the rule.
yeah, there aren't too many other places. So,
right.
So what gives rise to pan-Islamism and this reassertion of the concept of the Ummah, which, I mean, it's you know, being batted about a lot more frequently nowadays. Why is that on the ascendancy rather than pan-Islam or pan-Arabism?
Well, if we, again, in the kind of the post-colonial era, those two kind of pan the movements, pan-Islamism and or Islamism and Arabism, played out with, again, the territorial extent. We have Said Qutb, the main ideologue of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, his critique was of the Arab nationalism, of Nasserism of his time, and it was a critique of that, and it was of what was happening within Egypt. And if we see the Islamist movements that came out of that, you know, what we have is they were again played out within the territorial extent of the territorial situation they're in.
If we, right.
So we have, you know, Qutba, and then we have, you know, in other parts, Hezbollah dealing with their specific kind of nation state issues. So they speak of, you know, more broadly of pan-Islamism, but they're dealing with, you know, addressing kind of political and social situations within their own territorial context.
Right. And
the Muslim Brotherhood, again, had broken down into, you know, different kind of, let's say, national organizations.
Yeah, that was the example that I was going to bring up there, because it's very clear. Muslim Brotherhood was a concept. You can even just hear it in its name. Muslim Brotherhood is starts in Egypt, but rapidly moves to other countries. And you think, well, this is a big pan-Islamic movement, but it does have its own, each branch has its own national flavor, I would guess.
Yes, exactly. Responding to issues within
right.
their own context.
So that gets us here to what your thesis is, and how you would respond to the Huntingtons and Lewis's and this question of whether territory is insignificant to Islam or the Ummah in that regard. So how would you answer? I mean, to what extent is territory still important in defining how people within the Muslim world relate to one another? And if you could give us some examples of that.
Okay, well, let's step back, and I don't want to limit this to the question, although I do in this paper, but I don't want to limit this discussion of the importance of territory to the Muslim world. This has, you know, been, again, it arose as kind of a European Western idea, but it's been exported throughout the world, but it's something we all share today. This is territory, and the ideas behind it is it's an international system. And so if we step back and kind of look at developments we see going on right now, the Arab Spring, we could look at that, and people, you know, as soon as that arose, there were these questions of, you know, Iran 1979, but if you kind of just look at the imagery coming out of that, these were very explicitly kind of national movements. You didn't see the green banner of Islam being waved. You saw, you know, the Egyptian flag being waved. And I always think about the very kind of symbolic replacement of the Gaddafi era flag, Libyan flag, the green flag, where he drew on Islam and replacing it with the previous Libyan flag. Very nationalistic. These are nationalistic movements. Okay, if we can think about maybe this has been, kind of the effects of the institutions of territory taking effect, and the people, demanding again that their states represent them. You know, this question, of course, is it just bad governance? And yeah, that's part of it also. most definitely. But there's also these have been framed as very explicitly nationalist movements. If we see now, if we look at Egypt, you know, people are expressing fears about the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamism there. But the Muslim Brotherhood, they're not responding to this idea of the Ummah. They're responding to issues that are salient in Egypt to Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to step back and say, is, you know, Islam going to be part of kind of a more democratic governance within this region? Well, most definitely it will be, you know, in certain areas, and it'll play out differently in different states and different territorial circumstances. So
how much do you think this is more of a tactical situation, right? These groups are really expressing everything in nationalistic terms. You know, this is us to clean up Egypt and get rid of Mubarak, or to deal with the mess that Assad has given us in Syria, et cetera, et cetera. Because, I mean, you got to start somewhere. And so we're going to fight this battle now. We're going to clean up Egypt. But, you know, maybe somewhere down the line, do some of these states start to align with one another? Is there, does pan-Islamism reassert itself? I mean, in some ways, I'm just thinking off the top of my head right now. You see this in Europe, the movement toward pan-Europeanism and through the European Union. Is that something that we could see within the Islamic world, which by the way is a very big world? We can't, right. We got to remember, it's not just the Arab Spring and Egypt and Libya and Tunisia. This extends all the way to Malaysia,
right? And up into Russia,
right? Tatarstan, and
right. Yeah. Well, I don't really want to speculate on the future, but if we kind of look at, you're talking about broader geopolitics and state alignments. It wouldn't surprise me if we might see that happening. But if we kind of like break it down, and this idea that states are going to identify, Islam is going to create these blocks. Let's look at the example of, you know, Iran and its relationship to its northern neighbor Azerbaijan.
Mm-hmm.
Azerbaijan has been kind of locked into this so-called frozen conflict with Armenia over a separatist region. And you would think that Iran would side with Azerbaijan over this. They're both Shiite Muslims. But no, in fact, Iran is allied with Armenia on this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what is behind this? Well, there are issues. If we look at Iran, and this is kind of stepping back here in this conversation, you know, this idea of the 79 Islamic Revolution, you know, really this was kind of a Shiite revolution that was going on there, a reaction to the Pahlavi regime that tried to enforce Persian nationalism within Iran, when in fact Persians only made up about half the population. And we can't forget that a quarter of the population in Iran are, in fact, Turkic-speaking Azeris to the north.
Right.
You know, and so there's that anxiety over that border, and you know, Tehran doesn't want to strengthen, I guess, Baku's hand over these other territorial issues and embolden them. So we can see like these states within their territorial extents have developed their own interests. So sure, there might be kind of a block coming up that we could think about sometime in the future, kind of the equivalent to a European Union. But at this point, I wouldn't be willing to speculate on
yeah.
that.
Yeah, definitely. You make a very good case with the Iran, Azerbaijani, Armenia
mm-hmm.
conflict there, that territory still matters.
Right.
And especially when you get into power. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you have to control those territories. Because the other example that I was thinking of, too, again, you have the 1979 Iranian Revolution. And this, you know, if you were a pan-Islamist, you would say, oh, my gosh, this is the first start of this pan-Islamism. We're taking over territory, and soon we'll all be, you know, brothers. And yes, they are Shiites and we're Sunnis, but, you know, maybe we can overlook that. Who knows? Maybe that's what people were thinking in the 1980s. It changes over time. We see Iran and Iraq going to war. We see this conflict with Azerbaijan and such. But what about movements like Al-Qaeda and ones that are not associated with any particular territory. In fact, Al-Qaeda seems to draw people from a lot of different places, from Yemen, from Egypt, from Saudi Arabia. Boy, they're coming from all over the place, and they're moving all over the place. I mean, Al-Qaeda has been known to recently head into northern Mali, and the conflict that has been going on there in recent months is an indication of, well, you know, there's a number of different Islamic brothers who associate with Al-Qaeda who are moving into these. What about that group or groups similar to that?
I can't profess any expertise on Al-Qaeda and these groups. If we kind of look at let's look at the rise of the Taliban, okay? You know, the rise of the Taliban expressed as, again, this Islamic movement. But you know, if we look at, you know, the cultural contents of Afghanistan and going into Pakistan, in fact, you know, Taliban is a Pashtun national movement. You know, the Pashtuns that form the core and then the majority of those people, and so you can see them incorporating this type of Islamic jihadi type of discourse. But we have to question, you know, how much of this is Islam, how much of this is, you know, jihadist, but how much of this is actually a kind of a question of group national identity vis-a-vis other people within this territory that has been left to them.
Yeah.
And so, I guess the short answer is I can't really get into that with without my expertise. But we'd have to look at kind of the territorial situation within each of these states and see what might lend itself to these groups gaining a degree of popularity.
Yeah, the Taliban is an interesting case because we do, you know, at least in our Western media, tend to look at them as a very broad pan-Islamist movement. But, I mean, it came to power basically by controlling a very specific strip of territory in Afghanistan that controlled a very important trade route.
Pashtunistan also is the idea behind there, you know, and helps explain why Pakistan has been hesitant to go after them,
right?
Because Pashtunistan extends into what is Pakistan today, and the idea is that you don't want to you hopefully don't want to make an enemy of a person that could probably create issues with your borders.
Yeah, redefine borders or create a lot of strife and chaos within yours.
You have to pay attention to the borders that were left behind within those areas. And you know, the UN came into being after World War II, you know, committed itself to upholding, you know, the rights of self-determination of nations, but on the other hand, it upheld professed the ideal that will protect the territorial integrity of its member states.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very clearly these two principles are in conflict, and when they've come into conflict, it's usually they side with the status quo of protecting those borders.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is the effort within states, you know, to try to nationalize their populace.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is what we see if we look at the borders that were left behind for Pakistan. It's a very ethnically and even religiously diverse, you know, yes, Islam broadly speaking unites them, and so that becomes the focus of the nation, defining the nation, Islam, as an Islamic nation. It's an Islamic state explicitly there.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look again, you know, Pakistan is quite divided ethnically, as is Afghanistan.
Right.
And so when we think about these, you know, quote unquote, you know, jihadist groups coming in, we have to look at again the political territorial circumstances within each of these containers, and look at what might give rise to a popularity among them.
Yeah, and it might be easy for groups like Al-Qaeda to, you know, that is not territorially laden with anything, to be very pan-Islamist and to talk about Ummah because, well, you know, they don't control territory or significant amounts of territory, and they don't have to deal with a lot of ethnic rivalries and where to draw boundaries.
Yes, exactly. Or they might get, you know, or they might gain popularity among a certain, you know, kind of sub-state ethnic group,
right,
and latch onto those type of discourses.
Yeah, yeah. So let me just throw this out as a last question to you as we close up our podcast here. You began by noting that you study Tartistan, and that's been one of these cases we don't hear very much about because it's not in a great deal of conflict. It seems to be rather peaceful, and everything is just working fairly smoothly there relative to anything around it. Is that a vision of what the future might be over time, and what are some of your thoughts on that?
Tatarstan seems to be a bit of an exception, and this is, again, part of the, one of Russia's biggest challenges over the past 20 years is finding kind of a post-imperial identity. Historically identified with Orthodox Christianity, then atheism, and in the post-Soviet era, it's come closest to matching the nation-state ideal. We have, for the first time, ethnic Russians constitute a clear majority, 80% of the population. But what had happened with, in the Soviet era, you'd created these kind of sub-state territories, quasi territories within there, to give a semblance of homeland and statehood to these non-Russian groups like the Tatars and the Chechens and so forth. Is Russia a model for the rest of the world? I would be very hesitant in speculating on this. But what if we look at this part of the world, is that the Russians, the Orthodox Christians, and the Sunni Muslim Tatars have lived together for nearly 500 years in that area,
mm-hmm.
and a certain integration, a common culture, has arisen, and we see politicians in that area, especially, putting forth and creating discourses of commonalities, not only between the ethno-national groups, but even among the religions in that area, and talking about a certain harmony between them and tolerance. And so this is kind of important how you discuss it. But I'd be hesitant to take that as a model for the rest of the world, because, again, if we look at territories, we're going to have to kind of historicize how they came into being, when they entered the broader nation-state system, and look at the cultural contents of them and the historical experience within there.
Well, that is a project that we definitely will keep our eyes on, and you've given us a great deal of thoughts, ideas, and a wonderful framework from which to look at that. And I will remind our readers once again that your paper is available free online. With all you have to do is register over at the Interdisciplinary Journal of Research on Religion over at Baylor. We'll make sure that we link to that on our podcast or our website. So please stop over and visit that. And Matt, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.